What's really unusual about this video is that it's almost 15 minutes long. So in terms of public speaking, this violates all the rules. Okay? But this is this video is related to events that took place on September 11th that very few people know about. Huge impact in terms of, you know, this will be something that will be in history books probably 10, 15 years from now in terms of significant events that happened, and you'll actually be able to say, well, I think most of you can say, I was alive during then. And then I want to kind of build off of that in terms of some of the impact that it left on me and why I think it is pertinent for today. Any luck? Ooh, this is looking good.
I thought I was watching a movie, Towering Inferno at first. And then I looked to go close, and I noticed it was the World Trade Center. I was compelled, because I'm a type of person that can't stand by and watch other people suffer. And to me, they were suffering, they wanted to get off the island. And there was no way for them to get off the island other than the water. And I noticed, when I was watching the television, I saw a lot of, there are ferries coming up into the slips and taking people off. I said, fine, you can do the same thing. I can take people on my boat. Either they take them where they have to go. And that's what we did.
On the morning of September 11th, when the towers came down, millions of people ran for safety. Hundreds of thousands of them ran south to the water's edge. That's when they realized that Manhattan is indeed an island, and that they were trapped.
They were feeling helpless, and that's the worst feeling in the world. What was a person on the ground going to do? Buildings were down, you know, people laying under the rubble of the building, firemen, civilians. My wife was there, and I turned around and I said, I've got to go do something. Just like that. He looked at me and he says, what are you going to do, you maniac? I said, I'm going to take the Amberjack up into the city and help. She says, but what if they're attacked again? I said, well, then that's something I have to live with. I says, I have to do what I have to do. I says, and nobody can stop me right now. Even if I save one person or I rescue one person, that's one person less that will suffer and die.
You heard the building go down, but we're in the slip, so we can't see it. That's when we saw red and all, and all of a sudden, it engulfed. You couldn't see anything.
People were actually jumping into the river and swimming out of Manhattan. Boats were very nearly running them over.
These people wanted to paddle their hands no matter any way they could.
Somebody wants you to go over there!
Every mode of transportation out of Manhattan was shut down. All the subways were shut, tunnels were all closed. They closed the bridges, they closed everything immediately.
Boats, usually an afterthought in most New Yorkers' minds, were for the first time in over a century, the only way in or out of Lower Manhattan.
Human nature. You see people in distress on the seawall, and Manhattan is begging you to pick them up.
Yeah, pick them up.
They didn't know what was going on. They seen the building getting hit with these two planes. As far as they were concerned, you know, we were being bombed. I was wondering if they were going to come on the boat, if they were having people bomb, or if they were going to come on. We're a big orange target in the middle of that arm. My job is to keep the boat safe, but the airplanes are safe, my crew is safe.
Everybody's been shot, running around there. One week of family, they have a lot of ones running around safe.
Onto the boat, he grabbed onto the metal, climbs up right next to the pilot. So I'm going after him, think of him. He slides down to the next deck. So the deck hand can go, well, you know, what are you doing? He comes, I'm jumping for my life. So, you know, he could argue with him there.
Hundreds of boats converged on the city, leaving the sun-bathed harbor behind. Dead ahead, the unknown. That was something I won't forget. It was just low, dark, acrid, black smoke. It's like there was a big chimney in Manhattan. When we pulled into Pier 11, the dust was unbelievable.
And then out of nowhere, you just kept on seeing people coming.
They looked like zombies coming through the fog. And you knew that they were, those were human beings.
Don't leave us. Please don't leave us here. Take us.
At that point, the Coast Guard said, not how many people are you allowed? How many people can you fit?
Off the bunk, and then the Kansas Frank Bank who paid the destination on.
Some of these people have never been in the water, never been on a boat before.
Housewives, officers and witnesses, we have executives. And then there was the best. Everyone helped him.
His son was on her boat. He actually came up.
Exactly.
We went back and forth all day long, carrying boatloads, as many as our boat would hold. There's a lot of people. A lot of people.
You couldn't have planned them to happen that fast, that quick.
No training. This was just people doing what they had to do that day.
You forget all about what you're supposed to do, what to teach in school, and you say, you know what? Morally, this is the right way to go, and deep down, this is what I'm going to do.
Average people, they felt up. When they needed to. They showed me, you know, when American people need to come together and pull together, they won't do it.
I feel a way of honor that I was part of it.
That's the greatest thing I ever did in my life.
The greatest day that I've ever seen in all my voting, my life on the war.
The great boat lift of 9/11 became the largest sea evacuation in history. Larger than the evacuation of Dunkirk in World War II, where 339,000 British and French soldiers were rescued over the course of 9 days. On 9/11, nearly 500,000 civilians were rescued from Manhattan by boat. It took less than 9 hours.
I believe somebody has a little hero in them. You gotta look in. And it's in there. It'll come out. It'll need to be.
I have one theory in life. I never want to say the word I should have. If I do it and I fail, I tried. If I do it and I succeed, better for me. And I tell my children the same thing. Never go through life saying you should have. If you want to do something, you do it.
I can't tell you how many times I've looked at that video or how appreciative I am of the person who made me aware of it. There's two statements in it that jump out at me. The first one was that this was the first time that the people on Manhattan realized that they were an island. The question I want to propose in that first statement this morning is, how often do we really connect with the fact that Earth is a planet? And when I use the word if this morning, it's not because I call it into question, but if Scripture is true, then at some point in time, this planet as we know it is going to cease to exist. All through the New Testament, there are teachings about end times. Now, those teachings tell us that none of us know those end times, not even Jesus himself. Only God the Father knows those end times. But in spite of that, from almost the very moment that Jesus uttered those words in Matthew 24 and also in Mark and Luke, there have been Bible students, followers of Jesus, very learned people who have tried to figure out from the Scriptures when possibly those end times will actually transpire. Probably the person who's made the greatest headlines in recent time is this individual by the name of Harold Camping. And some of you may remember back in October, there were billboards everywhere. And he was convinced that on May 21st, the end was coming. He also recalculated that after it was over and decided that he had missed it and it was actually going to be on October 21st. The bottom line is that he's just one of hundreds who have tried to deal with this concept that there is an end time. Jesus in his teaching says, "You will know the end times are coming." He says, nations will rise against nations and kingdom against kingdoms. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are just the beginning of the birth pains of the end times. I've now been ordained almost 40 years. And I haven't served a lot of churches. My pastors have been relatively long, but everywhere where I have served, there's always been those who genuinely in their hearts feel that we're living in the end times. You know, they read passages like this and they say, gosh, you know, Pastor Ron, it looks like we're in the end times. What do you think? I think the intensity of those questions are beginning to pick up. It's understandably why those questions are picking up. I found it really, really fascinating that on September 12th of this year, the lead article in Newsweek was entitled this, "Time to Brace for the Next 9/11. The biggest threat to America isn't terrorism, it's the wrath of Mother Nature." And then the article went on to just describe the things that have gone on. I don't know if you are aware of what's going on in our world, but there's just been almost seismic number of natural disasters, and they seem to intensify in their magnitude, and there seems to be almost no downtime in between them. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of it, but some of the worst flooding in over 100 years is taking place right now in Asia. I mean, it's absolutely devastating. In one province of Thailand alone, Pakistan alone, where one of our missionaries from Union is serving, 60,000 heads of cattle have died. Now, that's just not their food source, that's their livelihood. Those are the cattle that pull their plows through their ground. And their ground is 3 feet underneath the water. And there's no place left for it to drain. They figure it'll take 5 or 6 months before they'll even get the water out of there. There's so much water. And as Americans, we have almost no awareness of what's going on anywhere else in the world because of the natural disasters in our own country. This last year, there were more natural disasters within the confines of the United States, possibly in 1 year, than in our entire history. The flooding that took place in our country this last year is the worst flooding in 4 decades. So there's a lot of people out there asking the question, what is going on? And for those that have any kind of an inclination of any kind of a biblical awareness of an end time, they're asking non-believers, is this the end? Is this what the Bible is teaching all about? And then, you know, I'm fascinated because, you know, there's also, you know, every aspect of our society is caught up on it. Some of you know that there's a new movie coming out. I'm not sure when it's coming out. I think it's about 6 months away. But, you know, it's going to be entitled, if I've got it down right, December 21, 2012. Well, what is it all about? The movie is a fictional representation of the end of the world, but it's based off of the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar, which is thousands of years old and has been phenomenally accurate. And, you know, people kind of go, well, you know, the Mayans down there in South, you know, in Mexico and Central America, you know, they were just kind of in a world of, but the last day on their calendar, written thousands of years ago, is December 21, 2012. So there's a whole secular school of thought that's beginning to evolve, saying, well, you know, look at what's happening in our world and just all the natural phenomena that's going on. Maybe the Mayans were right. You know, forget about the Bible, but maybe the Mayans were right. It's all coming. There have been so many natural disasters in our country this year that you may not be aware of the fact, but FEMA, our national organization for responding, it's bankrupt. If there's any more, since August, any more disasters in our country, FEMA has no money to come and help. FEMA has already said, we can't help anyone that has a new natural disaster. We can't give any more money to those disasters that have already happened because there's no money left in the coffers. Now, that's not the first time in our country that FEMA has gone belly up because they ran out of money. But because of how dysfunctional Washington, D.C. is right now, it's the first time that Congress has not released money to help FEMA meet the needs of our own people. So, you know, between now and the end of the year would not be a good time for us to have an earthquake. You know, it just wouldn't be a good time because there would be no help from our government. It has nothing to give. It's shut down. This is so preoccupying people that I read an article that one of the big game companies, video game companies, they're almost in the final stages getting ready to release a new game that they think is going to be just a sensational game. That they're going to make millions off of this game. Guess what the name of the game is? New World Disorder. New World Disorder. And people are beginning to throw out, well, what is it going to be about? Is it going to be about government upheavals? Is it going to be about natural disheavals? What is it going to be about? No one realized that Manhattan was an island until the day that they needed to get off of it, and there was no way to get off of it but by boats. How often do we deal with the reality that Earth really is a planet? And when that day comes that possibly it begins coming apart at the seams, is there a way off of it? That leads me to the second statement that was made in the movie that caught my attention. That captain who said, never say should have. Never say should have. Last month as I was on my way to Milpitas to Christ Community Church to meet with a group of guys that I've been in a covenant group with now for almost 30 years. So they drove into the driveway of the church. They're in a more friendly environment in terms of the community, in terms of what churches can do. And so they have a digital sign out there and read out and everything. You could never do that in Los Altos. I mean, we can't even put a sandwich board out without getting in trouble. But, you know, so here's this 8x10 foot digital readout, and as I drove up, it said, "Who's in heaven because of you? Who's in heaven because of you?" Question I want to leave with you as I bring my thoughts with you towards a close is, to what extent do you have a sense of passion for the lost spiritually? Jesus shared these words with the 72 in Luke 10, verses 1 and 2. After this, the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he is about to go. He told them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest field." Isn't that interesting? One of the things that has remained consistent all the way from the beginning is the lack of available individuals that the Lord can use to make the good news of salvation known. That message is not made known through preachers. That message is made known through individuals like yourself who are willing to live out your faith in such a way that it causes others to ask questions about what your life is about. Those of you who are willing to be salt and light, as Jesus talks about in Matthew 5, Jesus says, you know, let your light so shine that others may see your good deeds. You catch that? good deeds, people who are out there, you know, not hiding in rooms, but out in the world engaging with people and doing things that cause people to say, what is going on here? Why are you here? Why are you engaging with me? And because of the credibility of that relationship, opens up the freedom for discussion to talk about Jesus. I know that there's an awful lot of things that preoccupy us, that get our attention. But if Scripture again is correct, we're just here for a spit in the bucket. And what God is concerned about is that the good news of a personal relationship with Him through Jesus Christ is made known to everyone. Everyone has an opportunity to hear and to respond. Paul writes to the Thessalonians, God is not slow about His promise about bringing things to closure in this life as we know it, but He desires for all to be saved. And so, you know, the reason why the clock at times seems stalled is because God doesn't want to lose any more than humanly possible. Who are the boats for planet Earth? The boats for planet Earth are you and me. We're the vehicles in the rescue moment. Do we wake up in the morning and say, you know, God, if there's any individual that You desire for me to connect with today, to not necessarily even share the whole message, but You desire for me to begin making a connection with, are you open and receptive to doing that? You know, in all honesty, I don't pray that prayer as much as I ought to. And the reason why is because if God answers it, it's going to mess up my day. You know, my calendar's already full. I don't need someone coming into my life asking faith questions. I mean, that's going to be pretty consuming. What if we really lived our lives with a willingness to permit God to use us the way He wants to use us in conversation, in action with others? Sometimes we end up praying for people that we never are the one who engages with. I used to challenge people saying, you know, the likelihood of you leading your own young adult child to the Lord is probably pretty negative right at this point. That's probably not going to happen. But in the same manner that you are praying that someone else might connect with that adult child and eventually bring them to an understanding of who Jesus Christ is, are you also willing to have for you to be that person in the life of someone else's child? Now, are you open and receptive for God working in and through you? You know, I sometimes come in on the tail end of things in what I do. But I can tell you one of the experiences that I hate most in doing ministry. And that's walking with a family through their season of grief on the loss of a loved one. And them asking me all sorts of questions, trying to make sure that the person who's in the casket is okay. People get so desperate in wanting to know that the person in the casket is okay that, you know, it's not uncommon for me to find out that somewhere in the past, someone in their family was either a really good Christian in the family's perspective or a preacher. And they will go back 5 or 6 generations Maybe even further. I think we had a relative on the Mayflower, and you know, I think they were a pilgrim. I think they were a Christian. Is so and so okay? I'm probably not as brazen as I ought to be at those moments. I usually look at the person or those persons and say, you know what? The question you're asking me right now is strictly between the person who's deceased and God. Sometimes inside of my mind I'm going, you know, I think there possibly is a chance in this situation. Other times I'm going, how do you tell someone that the person they love blew it and they're probably in hell? Not the thing that you do, you know, the moment before a service starts or when you're spending some time with a family grieving. But I can tell you, there's a phenomenal difference between a family trying to resolve the uncertainty of someone's future state for all of eternity and a family that has real strong awareness that this person is with the Lord. I mean, it's more than night and day. It's incredible. Do we have a sense of passion for those who are lost? Whether they're in our family, whether they're in our friends, are we asking God daily for wisdom in terms of, you know, how do I put my boat out in front of them? Am I there and available for them if they decide they want to get on the boat and get off the planet, in a sense, into eternity? Am I even willing? Or am I so caught up in all this stuff in our life that, you know, bottom line is, I really don't care. Sometimes I've shared with people that as they look at how the lack of passion that many of us live out our Christian life, the only thing I can conclude is that as Christians, we don't have any problem thinking that it's okay for people to go to hell. Doesn't bother us at all. If it did weigh on us a little bit more, I think that we would live our faith out possibly at times differently than we do. What does that sense of urgency look like? Well, for my dad, it meant that he prayed for his dad, at least from what my mom tells me, every day for 32 years. Every day for 32 years. Whenever I think of that, I get so convicted. And I have a hard time praying for the same thing for a week. And to think that my dad prayed for his dad every day for 32 years. I think my mom must have gotten sick and tired of it after a while. But, you know, I can believe it because, we would have breakfast. This is after I'm an adult and married and I have my own kids. And I can remember, you know, you could see how my dad's life began, his own sense of passion growing as he got older. But, you know, breakfast would be served and we would sit down for breakfast and my dad would have us all hold hands together and then he would start praying. And he would end up praying for everyone that was at the table. He would, you know, I didn't know our family was so big. I mean, my dad would just keep on praying and praying and keep on praying and then we were praying, you know, I didn't even know who all the people my dad was praying for, and I'm trying to keep my toddlers relatively calm at the table while Grandpa just, you know, just his heart just pouring out for people, and I'm going, the cereal's getting warm and the pancakes are cold, you know, come on, Dad, wrap it up, you know, please, you know. But the flip side of it is there was this great sense of passion. And then he lived it out in his life, not preaching at people, but coming alongside of them. But, you know, he wasn't afraid to ask someone if they had ever considered Jesus Christ in their life. And he was always ready to respond. My dad was an accountant, worked in a small international firm. One time someone was talking to the president of the company and asking them about their HR department and if they had someone in their HR department that worked with people and counseled them during difficult times in their lives that could have an effect upon their effectiveness in the workplace. And they said, no, we don't have anyone like that. We don't need them. They just go down to the accounting department, to Luther McHattie's office, and they go inside that office and they ask Luther if he would pray with them. And so people would stop and sometimes, you mean you're second in command of your financial area of your company works as your therapist? No, he's not our therapist. Well, he's our chaplain. And you don't know, we don't need a therapist. If you have an issue, you go down to Luther's office, and when his door's closed, no one in this company knocks on that door because they know that what's going on behind that door is more important than anything that's going on in this company. And as a company, we're going to benefit because of what happens behind those doors. I don't know how many years my dad worked for that firm for him to establish that level of credibility. But are we living our lives in such a way that we do have that kind of credibility with us? Will you live your life out so that at some point in time, when you hit 40, people will look at you and say, you know, if there's somebody you really need to sit down and have a conversation with, if there's somebody who will really care for you, you know, this is the person, you just go down the hall to their office. Paul put it this way. I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible, he says in 1 Corinthians. To the Jews I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law. As to those who win those who are under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all of this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessing. In other words, Paul was saying, I'm willing to do almost anything imaginable in order to win the right to share my faith with another. So I've been here 2 years. And I know quite a bit about Cornerstone. I knew about Cornerstone before I came here because of my years at West Valley. But this is my final thought for Cornerstone. That you would never lose your sense of urgency for the good news in Jesus Christ. And if you have, or if you don't have it, that you will yearn for it and pray for it. Because without it, in terms of the greater picture of what God's trying to accomplish, there's no need for a cornerstone any more than there is a need for a union or for any church. The day that any community of faith becomes consumed about just taking care of itself and loses its understanding that earth is a planet. And there are people every day on this planet who have no way off of it for eternity. The day any of us loses that sense of passion, there's no reason for us to be around. The best thing that God can do is take us out of the picture. Get us to heaven as quickly as possible so that we won't be a distraction for those who have the sense of passion, for those who don't know Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that you will continue to be with Cornerstone as you have in the past, that you will bless them abundantly, that you will never permit the passion for you and for the lost with which they came into existence to ever be lost. And if there are days when it begins to flicker, that you would stir that fire through your spirit in some manner that they would reignite themselves so that those whom they can reach who are lost might be saved. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Let's all rise at this time. As we sing this last song, let's just respond, not just by singing.